New ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Will Palmer, co-founder and chief executive of Moovio. Moovio is known as the global leader in marketing, data analysis, insights, and campaign creation and management for theatrical exhibitors and distributors. Its mission is to revolutionize the way the film industry interacts with viewers, increase box office revenue, and improve the quality of the content that's produced. Will, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem.
We're really excited to have you here. And before we dive into the nitty-gritty, for listeners who might not be aware of your firm, can you please give sort of the elevator pitch description of Moovio?
Yeah, sure. So Moovio's purpose is to connect everyone with their ideal movie. And so we've built applications that build audiences based on data for movies and connect with them, whether that be across email or SMS or through their favorite digital channels, and try and connect them to movies that they're most going to want to see at the theater.
Okay, and where do you operate? Are you global? Which markets are you in?
Yeah, so we're in 40 different countries around the world. By the end of the year, that should be 50, so fairly sizable. We have offices based in Los Angeles, London, Shanghai, and Auckland, New Zealand, and our headquarters are in Auckland, New Zealand.
Great. The evolution of data into the marketing of entertainment is relatively new, and certainly Moovio is ahead of the curve. So I have a sort of two-part question for you. Why is what you're doing essential for entertainment companies, and where do you see things headed?
Yeah, well, I think traditionally data's been used there hasn't been any available to studios who are responsible for marketing films. And so primarily what they've had to do is they've had to rely on your sort of traditional demographic-based marketing, you know, using age and gender-based ad buys to reach an audience. Where Moovio treats things very differently is we look at everything based on your behavior. So we don't care if you're an 80-year-old that loves the Avengers or an 18-year-old that loves Victoria and Abdul. It's how you spend your time and money that really matters and what your tastes are. And so Moovio's whole approach is by looking at the history of what people are doing and building a profile of every moviegoer and then making that profile available so that the studios who have got the big marketing budgets can actually connect directly with those that are most likely going to want to see the film. Mm-hmm. And so the benefit to that should be that the studio manages to create a really efficient and effective marketing campaign. The cinema chain ends up having a lot more people come through their doors that sit in their seats and watch their movies. And the patron, the cinema goer, they get to see movies that they really want to see. And I think that combination creates quite a neat win-win-win situation for all.
Absolutely. I think probably the executives are somewhat more familiar than initially they were with data, what with sort of the internet and the expectation that when placing a digital ad, you could have far much more information than doing, let's say, something on broadcast television. And so you really are moving the cinema experience into that same sort of digital realm. How do you help refine the marketing strategy? You know, sort of what's the feedback loop and how do you help them improve their ROI and their marketing spend?
Yeah, so one of the things that we have is a pretty comprehensive research platform that looks at moviegoer behavior across many, many years, across many millions of moviegoers. And by using their past, we're able to use that to try and predict what's likely to happen in the future. So a lot of that historical data is used to try and predict what films people are quite likely to see. But then once we activate against that, once we connect with that group of people that we've suggested are the right audience for the new film coming, we are connected to all of the point of sale systems at all of the leading cinema chains that we work with. And so what you're able to do is target a group of moviegoers with a really specific message and then at the box office measure whether that actually yielded box office return. And so you can then see, did this advertisement or this connection that we made with the moviegoer, did this bring us more people to the theaters or not? And if it didn't, what should we do next time? And it's that closed loop by measuring at the box office that's really unique because you're not just measuring links, clicks, and impressions. You're actually measuring conversion. And I think that helps you really refine that you know, your next time round, your strategy to build out, you know, success on a marketing campaign.
Right.
Additionally, obviously all the franchise films, right? So anything that is a franchise type based film, which a huge number are, we've got so much legacy data on those that follow the franchise that you're not starting from a zero base. You're starting from a base of consumers that you already know are probably going to be fairly captive to your film. So there's quite a few things that can be done to sort of enhance that media campaign.
Right. Oh, so many questions this sparks for me. I'll try to keep them all in my head. I think it's fascinating that you're able to track the evolution of an audience after not only historically, but also I read in one of your blog posts that you can track it after the film is released and that you actually can help shift the campaign. Is that correct? Did I understand that properly?
Yeah, you did.
So how is that operationalized? How does that work?
Yeah, look, I think the scenario there is it's probably more of a future state as far as what it could do.
Okay.
But I'll explain what audience evolution is about. So we've built a system that basically from the moment a film releases, we are profiling every single session that is playing. And we're aggregating that together to basically provide the studios a view into what is the audience makeup on the opening night and how does that change every day and every hour from then right through to the close of the film. And what we did is we tried this out once on, I think it was a Straight Outta Compton when that was released, and we saw that the audience changed significantly from the date that it opened to the date that it closed, almost a different audience. We then overlaid six or seven other significant films, blockbuster-type films, and realized that there was actually a pattern, that people actually attended movies in a pattern, and if you knew that pattern, you could market to it. And so one of the things that we started talking to the executives at the studios about was this concept of audience evolution and this idea that actually you can chase the audience after release and that you don't need to spend everything right up front to get a great opening. What you need is to be able to do that, yes, but also have enough chase funds available to chase the audience once the film releases. And I think in the future, when the studios sort of get aware of what the opportunity is here and marketing technology sort of catches up as well, I can imagine that this data that we have on the evolution will be used to dynamically change the ad spend after a film releases to chase the right audience for that film. Right. And so I think that's a really exciting new opportunity. It also will mean that really good films will get really long runs because we'll be able to identify that right audience quite early and then move the digital spend to that audience to make sure that they're coming to that film.
Right. That's amazing. In many senses, when we think about marketing and promotion, data has become sort of table stakes and the creative needs to be there to engage. And so I'm curious how all the pieces come together. You have the so what that the data tells us, the now what, where you're going to spend it. Are you also dealing with them in terms of the creative and whether it is marketing on the promise that the film actually will deliver? Do you get involved in those conversations with them?
That's the one area that we steer clear of. And I guess that's probably where, where sister companies like Powster get involved. But our view on this is that you're quite right with what you're saying about data. Like it started off with everybody needs to get big data. And so everyone ran around sort of building all these data stores. And then all of a sudden you had this unruly amount of data. I mean, we got ourselves in a situation where we had 150 filters that could be combined in any combination to analyze a film audience. And really it was your guess was as good as mine as to whether we were good at it or not. We then went to the world of artificial intelligence and machine learning, where we said, look, why don't we get, you know, artificial intelligence to run itself over our data and find what's interesting inside it. And that's where we are now. So now these insights are bubbling to the surface. Now, what that means in real terms is that the marketing departments can go back to being creative because what they were having to become was analysts. And that's two different mindsets, right? The person who can analyze data and build segments is a very different person to the one that can build beautiful creative that engages with that segment. And so our view is let us look after finding the ideal audience for your movie and allow the creatives to get on with what they're great at, which is creating engaging messages for the segments that we pull together. So I think whilst we don't get into that space, I think we've liberated the marketing and creatives to be able to go out there and be creative.
Right. Interesting. So there are so many different platforms out there. Do you help evaluate all of the touch points a consumer message might exist, the sort of 360 campaign, or are you limiting, you know, we're evaluating the efficacy of digital spend, or we're evaluating, you know, digital plus linear plus, I don't know, whatever. I'm having a brain gap at the moment, but what goes into the pot that's evaluated?
As far as the data that we're capturing?
Yeah, in terms of, you know, you are assessing the audience and who's going at the theaters and the ticket sales, but when you're telling them, here's where you need to place your advertisements, I know that I was reading one of the blog posts and you were talking about placing an ad in the New York Times that was appropriate to that particular consumer. And so that's a placement in a digital world. Do you also track what they might put on linear, they might do in print or out of home, or is it purely digital?
Look, it's purely digital, but I would say that linear television and radio are moving digital. So, you know, the addressable television, which is sort of your smart television or anything with a set-top box, will effectively mean that all of those households are as addressable as anyone is sitting on their desktop computer. And so we are already in a partnership with Viacom where we are able to reach people at the household level and measure at the box office whether that has created some form of engagement. So our role in this is to provide the ideal audience for the film and to measure whether that audience actually took an action as a result of the advertising. The stage following that and where we want to head with this is to basically help digital advertisers move their spend in real time to where they're getting the highest yield, mm-hmm. the highest engagement. And that will be across obviously all your more, you know, logical digital channels, mm-hmm. but also addressable television and, you know, digital radio as well. Mm-hmm. So at the moment, that's very much our remit. We think the whole ad space is heading digital. So for us, it's just a matter of time before the data that we provide will be used across, you know, a wider spectrum of channels.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm right with you there. Absolutely. I think that's where things are going. So you had said, you know, your machine learning is what you brought to bear. And is that the machine learning is what then saw some of these patterns? Is that what happened? And did any of the patterns revealed surprise you?
I think they always surprise us, particularly when you start taking out your bias towards demographics. You know, like it's really, really easy to, like, I'm a 55-year-old woman, according to my profile on Movio. If I don't,
little did you know.
I know I am. I really am. So, you know, I think you can back yourself into a little bit of a pigeonhole if you focus on the sort of demographic stuff. The behavioral stuff is really, really interesting. And so how we approach that, we sort of had sort of two starting points. The first one was we were looking at films and we're saying, what is another film with the most similar audience to that film? And so you'd look at, and this is a really good way of being able to sort of, you know, everyone watched Star Wars. So whenever you do that, everyone's on the Star Wars list, right? So what we had to do is build this sort of algorithm that was able to discount for films that were over-indexing. And then we built a scale, right? So we called this the audience similarity rating. Mm-hmm. And so this means that we can basically look at every film, graded out of 10, as to how similar that audience is to another film. 10 being, it's exactly the same, 0 being there's no similarity at all. And so what you're then able to do is start building out a comparable audience to do a targeted marketing campaign at, based around using one singular seed comp. And then it will effectively just continue to build out until you reach the size of audience that you want to reach and the, you know, as depending on how broad you want to go. And you'll know how accurate your audience is by looking at the aggregate score of your audience similarity score. So essentially, if your audience similarity score is like a 9, it's probably going to be a very small pinpoint audience, but it's probably going to be highly accurate and highly effective. If your score is like a 5, it's going to be a lot wider and, you know, there's going to be less people at 10, but you're going to get a bigger reach. And so that was the first thing we developed. And most of the studios are now using that to develop their digital segments rather than using age, gender, et cetera. So that was the first one.
Can I just, before you go further, seed comp, can you explain what that is?
Yeah, I should explain that. So whenever you make a film, you're generally making it because there was another filmed audience you were trying to attract, right? So you're looking at it, you're saying, we're going to make this film. It's really going to bring in the same audience that came to this film. And we, you know, that's what we call the seed comp, the original comp film, that sort of the genesis of why was this made. And if you can get the right seed comp, the most comparable film to the one that you're making with the one that you're about to release, you can model an audience against it very effectively. And we've actually looked at this another way, which is where you say, well, hang on, what about if you used all of the data that exists about this film that's about to release? You know its release date, and you know its actors, and you know the genres and the subgenres, and you know the marketing spend, and you know all these facts about the film. What if we put that into an algorithm and then spat out what the comp film was?
Oh, so we tried that out. Did that work?
It kind of works, but it's nowhere near as effective as having a singular comparable film used to start the process. And then you can really build out quite an incredible comparable audience for your film.
Can I just another sort of dogleg-ish question to that is, you know, a lot of the conversation today around the entertainment industry is unconscious bias. The studio system, primarily composed of white men, creates a landscape of which, you know, has certain things, that certain stories aren't as told. What do you do when you have a film that is different? I mean, I guess Crazy Rich Asians, did people know it would perform as well as it did, or Black Panther, or...
Let's talk about Black Panther. I mean, Crazy Rich Asians, we have, it was an interesting film in its own right, and there's a few reasons for that. One of the reasons it did well was that there was no competition around that window. So there's, you have to look at the competitive landscape on a film like that one. If we park that for a moment and look at Black Panther, which has probably got a little bit more history behind it, that film was a billion-dollar film, an absolute breakout. And it, what was interesting about it being a billion-dollar film is it was done with people that, you know, with stars that people had never met. You know, this was a new character introduced into market, so why did it work? Well, we could see it was going to work pretty early. It had two characteristics. One, it captured the core Marvel audience. So that core Marvel audience that likes all of the Avengers also attended that film in spades. And so that was a wonderful achievement from Disney. The second thing is it captured a whole new audience to Marvel, which was the, you know, underserved Hispanic and African American audiences in the US that hadn't really followed the Marvel characters. Mm-hmm. And so you now are capturing two distinctly different audiences for the same film. No surprise, the thing popped and it was a massive success. Of course, it was a good film as well. And so that is a really good example of a studio basically capturing and introducing a whole bunch of new people to a franchise.
Mm-hmm. What about something like Get Out? How would something like that, how would you evaluate that?
Yeah, Get Out's an interesting one as well. I mean, again, I think they've gone down, it would have picked up the African-American audience, obviously, with the leads in that film, which is unique, and it would have picked up the core horror audience. Mm-hmm. And the core horror audience is a really interesting one. About 40% of all the films they watch are horror. So they disproportionately, whereas the rest of all audiences watch only about 6% horror. So horror fans are horror fans.
That's great.
They really are. They come to everyone that's out at a pretty regular cadence. They've got a high frequency. They generally come sort of once a month. And so that's, you know, a pretty good audience if you get a good horror film out there. We've seen that with The Nun in the last few weeks, the massive success of that film. But then you add the African-American component to it, plus the fact that I think it also had a suspense narrative to it that made it Oscar worthy. Mm. You're tapping different audiences. And I think that's what that film did really well, is it basically found two or three uniquely different audiences to bring into that film. And whenever you do that, that's when you get that kind of pop. If all you get is what you predicted you were going to get, then your film's going to be, you know, averaged at best. Right. But when you're able to, you know, tap into multiple audiences, that's when you really do see those kind of crazy results.
Is it possible to use this similarity score to help predict, sort of greenlight a concept or film, or to help them think about what demand is? For instance, what you just said about horror, that's fascinating. And do you sort of help in terms of development? You know, do they team with you, the studios team with you in that regard?
We've had a little bit of that happen. We've actually gone back even one step further and worked with some companies that are financing film that want to know whether this is a film they should finance based around, is there an audience for it? So we have gone right back to the sort of very beginning, but the creative process of making film is still not an area that we spend enough time in. Generally, Movio gets involved at the time when they're trying to plan the media plan. Mm-hmm. So the film is in its sort of final cut stages and they're looking for a way of it being able to reach the key audiences, and they're building out their marketing plan, and that's really the piece that we play. But absolutely, this would be very valuable to anyone who is in production or trying to make a decision on, you know, where should we go with this actor, or should we, you know, pick this film or this film based around how it looks like other films. So yeah, I think it's something we aspirationally would love to be more involved in.
So I'm curious, because you did talk about this actor or that actor, and you also mentioned franchises. As you look at the landscape of film and how people are attending, how important is the actor versus the franchise versus the director? I mean, are you seeing shifts in that?
It's different on different scenarios. I mean, I think it's a question we can easily analyze quite quickly. Like, for example, Tom Hanks. If you put a Tom Hanks into our similarity search, a film with him in it, you will find that the most similar audiences have Tom Hanks in it. So there's clearly a following for Tom Hanks. It's not just the quality of the films he's making, it's Tom Hanks himself.
Oh, wow.
Conversely, if you do Tom Cruise, you don't get the thing come back. His films do very well, but they're not necessarily following Tom. If you do Clint Eastwood as a director, you'll find that people will watch all of Clint Eastwood's films, regardless of the fact that they're often touching very different genres. So I think it does. It depends on the individual, and we can measure that quite simply as to whether, you know, there is an audience that is an audience that's following that actor, or whether it's the narrative that they're more interested in.
Goodness, it seems like agents should be talking to you, but they should analyze their clients and bring that to
you. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Tom Hanks should be definitely asking for a raise.
For more.
Yeah. There's no question there are actors there that people do follow, regardless of what type of film they're in, and directors are the same. But equally, there are a whole bunch that they really don't, and star power hasn't been the reason that those films have popped. And you can see that quite clearly in the data.
That is fascinating. I am so curious. I would love to see the list of the stars who don't have draw, you know, that they think that they're given box office props, but don't actually seem to be delivering on that. I think that's really interesting. So your consumer insights, how has GDPR changed that? I mean, are you pulling other behaviors? Has that changed how you do your operations or no?
GDPR is an interesting one because I think it's really just a sensible standard that the world will end up adopting. Mm. It's, you know, and it's kind of almost just a check and balance for everyone to say, hey, like, let's stop for a moment and let's look at where we are and go, what is the right thing to do with data? And GDPR effectively is putting forward what the right thing to do with data is. And we saw this coming a couple of years ago. This isn't new for us. And so we took a leadership role in making sure that our systems were compliant first and making sure that those that worked with Movio became compliant by working with us. And so we really did take a front foot on it. But effectively, it has no real effect on what we do. The data is still going to be collected in a compliant way, and that happens at the cinema chain and the relationship with the cinema and the patron. It's got to be processed in an effective way. And that's our part. We're a processor of data. And one of the key things is if somebody wants to remove their data from all systems, you must be able to hard delete it from everything, which technically was one of the hardest parts of the process, but we've completed that. So it really hasn't changed much. What I would say is it slowed the whole ad tech infrastructure and growth in Europe down considerably, where you have, you know, a pretty sophisticated and high-tech solution and market in the US. But in the UK, for example, it feels 2 or 3 years behind. And I think everyone's treading ground very carefully at this stage. I don't think there's been much tested at case law level. And once there is more that's gone through the courts and people understand how GDPR is going to be interpreted, I think you'll see things return more to a status quo.
Right. That's really interesting. You know, also, so you've been collecting data from the get-go. So by now, your data set must just be enormous. And you can also, you have this transactional history that changes over time. You know, there's a lot that's been written about millennials and what they will do as they age. And I'm curious, you know, I know that you were saying, you know, it really isn't so much about the demographics, that it's really about the behaviors. But I'm curious if you have seen a cohort, as that cohort ages, do they change? Or are people interested in what they're interested in? And is our mindset wrong?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. We did a white paper on millennials some time ago, really because it was the buzzword that everybody liked to use. And so we thought we better let's debunk some of the truisms about millennials. Mm. And we looked at it and, you know, a millennial is sort of, you know, aged, I don't know, what are they now? The oldest millennial is going to be 36 and the youngest is going to be, I don't know, 20-ish. Mm. And so that's the range now of what we're calling a millennial. And when you look at it, they're actually transitionals, because you can't put them in one bucket. Most 20-year-olds are still into your fanboy films and following all of your franchises and have to be the first to the movies. By the time you're into your late 30s, you're probably starting to have children, your frequency's changed, your film tastes has evolved, you probably started following some actors over your lifetime that you've grown up with, and so things change. And so I think you can't really band, you know, films around this concept of millennials. I think they're transitional and they're the ones that actually are most likely in that period to change their film taste. Hmm. And that's certainly what we saw in the white paper that we put together, that film taste evolves from 20 to 36 quite considerably, which I think is logical, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I think the thing about millennials, it's, you know, they talk about them not coming back to the movies or, you know, disappearing from the business. In reality, that's content driven, right? So if the content's being targeted at the millennials or the transitionals over that period, then they come out in droves, just like any other segment of the population. It's enormously content driven.
Right. You mentioned when we touched very briefly on Crazy Rich Asians, you said context. Context is so important. Absolutely agree. And I'm curious, do you also, are some of the data points that you're collecting context related, date related? I mean, what are the context points that you are tracking so that you can put that against what somebody's doing?
Yeah, and I think we could do a lot more work here, by the way. I think when you really want to understand what a moviegoer, I often get asked, you know, what's the effect of Netflix on or streaming or VOD on the theatrical business? Is it going to eventually take it over? And I look at that and go, actually, no, I don't think that's even related. Mm-hmm. The theatrical business is not competing with Netflix. The theatrical business is competing with all the other things you could do on a date night.
Right.
So you could go to the ball game. You could go to out to dinner. You could go to all these different things that are happening. You go to the comedy club. And it's got to be able to compete with those things.
Right.
And so then when you look at the competitive landscape and you think about a date on a film, you've got to look at what else is happening in that area at that time. Is the weather conducive to getting to the mall to be able to watch the film? Is there a major sporting event on television that day? Those things are all the bigger factors than the film itself and what other films it's playing against. So I think dating a film is really, really critical, and understanding the actual competitive landscape, not just the films playing around it, is also a key part. So I think if you want to really succeed, getting the date right is a combination of what are the other films and competitive films in market? What are the other competitive things that somebody could actually do? And put those two things together, and that gives you that date that hopefully means your film succeeds.
Well, right. And what you, if you're competing for date night, if that's really your competition, and I think you're absolutely right, then you're also talking about what your experience is, you know, what kind of experience you're getting. And I'm curious, do you think, are you seeing your theater chains interested in benchmarking against experiences in theater experiences? And do you deal with that at all with them?
From a point of view that we do quite a lot of survey NPS type things on the way out run on behalf of our cinemas, yes. And I think what you're probably seeing in the US and around the world, and certainly in Australia, which led the way in this space, the premium experience is where I think most of the major cinema chains are investing their money.
Right.
The recliners, the allocated seating, the in-theater dining, mm-hmm. the premium large screen formats, better sound. They are really putting their focus on creating an experience that really does compete with all other options. And I think if you look at some of the dining experiences you're seeing in theater now, you know, they're starting to compete with good restaurants. In fact, right. Some theaters, I would suggest, dine in first, theater second. And that's a really big change that's happening in market, because I think the cinema owners have realized that that experience is key, and that you can't just build a theater with a whole bunch of seats and they will come. It's got far more competitive than that. But yeah, we are seeing some amazing examples around the world of cinema owners and operators take the next level.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting here at the Alamo Drafthouse has really been doing really interesting things around the dining, the experience, having the food actually be tied into the film that's being shown. I mean, it gets quite complex. One other question I had is MoviePass.
Yeah.
I'm curious of, are you surprised by how things played out there, and how, you know, where you just have this sort of open ticket kind of situation? What were your thoughts around MoviePass?
Yeah, look, I mean, we were dealing with MoviePass in a friendly way before they dropped the price from $30 to sort of sub $10.
Mm.
And then from there, obviously, you know, they took off and got millions of subscribers. And I couldn't see at any point in time how it was economically sustainable to do what they were doing. Effectively, they were taking enormous amounts of investor money and buying people movie tickets, is how I saw it.
Right.
And it's effectively, I think, what's ended up happening. The reality of what they came in to do was to wedge themselves in between distribution and exhibition. And if you want to be disruptive, you need to remove a step, not add one.
Oh, interesting.
So, for me, I struggled to look at it and sort of think, oh, this didn't really work. I think the other key part to it was that they were unable to benefit from the ancillary income that happens in the cinema business. So if they were able to attract a lot of incremental visitation, which I think they did,
mm-hmm.
they weren't able to benefit from that because they weren't cut in on the concession and on all these other parts that they wanted to be cut in on.
Right.
So the business model, I think, really was flawed. I think the other thing I would add, I understand why you'd want to go so low, because you'd want to attract those occasional and infrequent moviegoers back to the movie business.
Mm.
But it's not like going to the gym where you buy a gym membership and you don't turn up. A movie theater is sitting in a chair eating popcorn. It's a lot easier to turn up. So you don't get the breakage, I think, that you would get in a gym membership model, which
right.
I think is another part that they were sort of hoping for. So my view on it is it was an unsustainable business model. It could have done really serious damage to people's expectations of price in cinema. And I hope that there isn't long-term damage from what has happened. But what I think it has done on a positive side is it's educated the US market that price sensitivity is a really big issue.
Right.
And that moviegoers really do, you know, will watch incremental visits if the price is right. And there's always been a very blanket price policy in the US that it doesn't move. There's no dynamic pricing like what you see in hotels or in airlines. It's rather rigid. And so this has sort of opened up everyone's eyes to the concept that, hey, not only is subscription a good idea, but price sensitivity is clearly an issue. And we take the view that each piece of content theoretically could actually be valued differently. I mean, if you took the opening of Star Wars, there was an article written that suggested there might have been as much as $1 billion left on the table worldwide because people would have been willing to pay significantly more to watch the opening sessions of Star Wars than face value. So pricing actually possibly goes both ways, and that there's probably room to charge a premium on those big releases that are selling out. Conversely, I think there's room to start looking at changing pricing and time on films based around the time of day or the success of the content.
Interesting.
And I think MoviePass played a part in sort of opening our eyes to that.
That's really interesting. So what do you think is the biggest thing on the horizon that everyone in the film business should be thinking about? What's that thing that you, when you walk into a meeting, you want to grab the people by the throat and say, listen, you've got to pay attention to this?
Wow. It's an interesting question. I don't have a really, really sort of concrete answer on it. I mean, for me, it's all about that everything's got to be centered around the moviegoer. And I think what, it sounds ridiculous, but I think that is the entire goal. If more moviegoers come to the theater more often and spend more, then the industry's going to thrive. And so what does the moviegoer want? And I think, and how do we communicate with them? And so instead of it being about, you know, data and dates and theaters and sort of the commercial side of the business, I think we need to go right back to the center point, which is both the studio and the exhibitor want more moviegoers to go to the movies. How can we work together as an industry to get more moviegoers to go to the movies? And I think probably the big thing I would suggest is that there still isn't the level of cooperation inside the business with that common purpose of bringing those moviegoers in to the theater. So that would be, for me, probably the centering point, bringing distribution and exhibition closer together and focusing on that what really matters, which is that moviegoer experience and bringing more of them to the theater.
Fantastic. Well, we've actually run through our time. Before we leave, how can people find out more about Movio?
Yeah, so movio.com is obviously our destination. We have all of our historical blogs and our white papers all there and available to see. Obviously, you can follow us on social media, Twitter and LinkedIn. And yeah, we could try and keep ourselves pretty well heard. So look out for us in most of the major media publications. Anytime there's someone talking about an audience, we hope that it's Movio that's giving you that information.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really interesting and a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.